This is the Monty American Graduate Special. It's an hour of true stories from the front lines of North Carolina's high school dropout crisis.
You have kids come in your classroom every day. You don't know what they're going through. And I've seen everything.
I'm talking to mom about leaving school. And I'm going, you know, these people are being awful to me at school.
I decided to drop out after I had been shuffled between two more schools. And I said, I'm just through with school. It's been too long of a road.
And actually, I wasn't legally able to quit school on my own. So I convinced my, you know, drug-induced mother to sign for me to quit school. That wasn't very hard, you know. I just drug her up to the schoolhouse. And that's what she did. She signed the papers, and I quit. And the next day, I got a job at Roses.
The only part of teaching that made sense to me way back in the beginning was the part I didn't think would come naturally to me at all. I could care about these kids.
This program was recorded live at Motoco Music Hall in Durham, North Carolina. It's produced by The Monty at North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Jeff Polish, founder of The Monty. We're a nonprofit organization that creates community through the telling of stories. We partnered with North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, for this show as a part of the American Graduate Project. It's a public media initiative made possible in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, GlaxoSmithKline, the Goodnight Educational Foundation, Joseph M. Bryan Foundation, and listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. Over the next hour, we'll hear from teachers and students who know firsthand the struggles that get in the way of a successful high school education. I worked with each of the storytellers and helped them with their narrative. But in the end, it was up to them to stand in front of the audience and speak from the heart. We begin with Bryn Saran from Southmont, North Carolina. It's a little town south of Winston-Salem.
I'm a little nervous. My parents decided to get divorced when I was a freshman in high school. They sat me down to tell me that they were getting divorced. A lot of decisions had been made about how my life was going to go at that point, where I was going to live, I was moving, where I was going to move, when I was going to move. I didn't have any control over any of this. I'm from a little bitty town called Southmont, North Carolina. That is where I was born and raised. And there are certain standards that you have to live up to. People in Southmont don't divorce. They live unhappy. they live hating each other. You know, that they do this forever. On top of that, I was dealing with a little bit of depression that comes with normal teenage stuff. Well, this caused even more, obviously, which causes serious antidepressants to be prescribed, which caused serious weight gain, which caused me to weigh 250 pounds as a teenager. Now, I'm sure that most of you are aware, but being a teenager is hard. It's hard anyway. Being a 250-pound teenager, that's really hard. And it really just, for no better word to use, it sucked. So I was 250 pounds, and I'm trying to find something that'll make me happy. You know, I mean, I can't go shopping with my friends anymore to reduce stress because I can't buy clothes at the same places that my friends do anymore. I can't shop for clothes in normal stores. I'm too big for them. I can't play sports anymore. I'm too big to do that. So I was like, well, what do I do? You know, so I joined JROTC. I was like, this will work. You know, this is good. They're a family unit, and I'm losing the family that I have at home, so I'll just do this. Well, I failed to realize that those really cool uniforms that they wear once a week, they don't make those for 250-pound girls. So I was putting a uniform on once a week that I was busting out of, which made me not quite fit in well at all. I just looked really out of place. So I was totally lost. And in the midst of all of that and all this stuff that I'm going through, I had been trying to keep under wraps that I was a lesbian. Back to the South Mind thing, you're supposed to marry a man and you're supposed to have kids. I wasn't going to live up to this. So I was trying to keep it quiet. Well, it came out in the midst of all of this stuff. I start trying to figure out a way to escape some of this, to get away from some of it. I started attempting suicide and harming myself. And about six times I tried to kill myself. And I don't know what I was looking for at that point. I had no idea. But I knew that that helped me get away from it for the moment. Because when I did it, I went into the hospital and they pulled me out of school. And they got me away from the people that were making fun of me. Or were giving me a hard time about my weight. And I'll tell you this. My mom and dad had very different styles when it came to raising me. My mom is permissive, and if I'm happy, she's happy. If it makes me happy, it makes her happy. My dad, however, and I love my father, is stern, and he wants me to learn from every situation, and he wants me to stick with it and make the best of it and do what I've got to do. So when my parents split up, I was spending these weekends with my dad and kind of this awkward silence of, I know you're unhappy with me, you know? I know that you don't like these things I'm doing, and I'm talking to mom about leaving school, and I'm going, you know, these people are being awful to me at school. They're not good to me. They're not good for me. So mom is supportive as always, and she says, okay, we'll pull you out. We've got some other options. We can homeschool. We can look at some other options that are out there. Dad is standing here going, no, you know, you've got to stick with it. You've got to do what you got to do, you know, and I'm going, Dad, that's not going to work, not in this situation. So when I pulled out of school, that gap between me and Dad went from about this big to about this big. And I didn't know what to do, you know. I had always had a relationship with my father. I mean, you know, and now there's this gap between us that's huge. So I'm spending weekends over there, and like I said, awkward silences. Slowly conversations start to come back around, some weird questions here and there. We start to talk a little bit, and eventually it starts to come back, conversations between me and my dad. And at one point, my dad looks at me, and he says, do you know how much it would mean to me for you to go back and get a diploma? It's important for me. It's important for you. You need one. You need to go back and do this. And I was like, okay, you know, maybe he's right. So I thought about it. I thought about it then. I thought about it all day, all night, all week. I thought about it. And eventually I decided that he was probably right, as he normally is about these situations. So I went back, and I got a diploma. Now, I didn't do it in the way that he wanted me to, but I got one, and he was proud of me for that. And the relationship between me and my father started to grow and started to become a real relationship again. I wouldn't have a diploma today if it wasn't for him. I wouldn't have graduated from school if it wasn't for him. So I owe him for the fact that I have a diploma today. And I'll forever owe him for that. Thank you.
Bryn Surratt lives in Summerfield, North Carolina with a girlfriend and stepdaughter. All right, let's move on to our next storyteller, Bill Kenyon. Bill, oh, we have some Kenyon heads, we like to call them. I know the term for fans of Bill Kenyon because he's a neighbor of mine. And that was a neighbor who just screamed. Or his wife, I'm not sure. I met Bill about 5 years ago, 4.5 years ago. Bill is a teacher. And I was a teacher. And Bill is a father of three boys. And I am a father of three boys right now. And the thing is that Bill is a great guy. I have never seen him teach. I have never seen him in a classroom at all. But I knew just from brief conversations that I had with him that he's an amazing educator. When I was approached about the American Graduate Program, this show, he was the first person that came to mind as a storyteller. So let's give him a big round of applause. Bill Kenyon.
Boy, that really made me feel welcome. I can't see anybody. Felt really welcome because that's how my students respond to me every time I come into the classroom. I'm from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I'm one of 11 children, all the same marriage, and come from a long line of ministers and teachers in the family. But one of the most defining times in my life was in the seventh grade. I hated the seventh grade. It was the worst 3 years of my life. And seriously, in seventh grade, when I my dad had lost his job, we had to move, and I end up at a new school. And one of the first days of walking down the hall, somebody cold-cocked me for no reason, and only because I was new, I guess. And when I came to, I was just, people were walking over me, and I was like, this is really going to be wonderful. But there was a group of kids in this school that were very, they were terrorizing the school. And the one boy was in eighth grade, probably about 8 feet tall. And I always, the school I used to go to, I always used a pillow slip for a book bag because it was really simple. But now when I get to this new school, that pillow slip became the topic of a lot of jokes. The Jer was the kid that was the leader of these bullies. And Jer, he would do it like this. He'd go, I'm the Jer, like that. But he was really big. And going to chorus, I would go to chorus late because Jer and Tom and Jerry. But we couldn't make that joke because you would die. Jerry one time had grabbed this kid, and this is a really defining moment for me, and it wasn't far from the office. He grabbed him, pulled him into the bathroom, and he said, give me your money! And I could just see, you know, because the one time I did go to the bathroom, which I never went to the bathroom in junior high after that, Tom and Jerry were smoking pot in there, and they had a broomstick, and this was early when I first got there, and while I was in there, they had broken it in half, and I was like, Lord, please, 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 let me go fast, and I went fast, and as I was leaving, the stick just missed my head, or one half the stick. That's why I didn't go to the bathroom anymore, but they had grabbed this kid and pulled him into the bathroom, and I could hear the kid screaming, so I turned around and ran down to the office. And the vice principal was sitting there, and he was socializing with the counselor. And I said, quick, quick, somebody's getting mugged in the bathroom, hurry. And the vice principal goes, oh, brother, I got it last time, it's your turn. And neither one of them jumped into action. And I remember at that moment, I thought, that will never happen when I'm teaching. So when I became a teacher, you have kids come in your classroom every day. You don't know what they're going through. You got a kid that's, you know, might be suicidal, or you got a kid that, you know, father committed suicide, and I've seen everything. So the school we're teaching at is an alternative school, and it's an alternative to suspension and expulsion. So some of the kids are placed there, court-ordered to be there, and some of the kids are volunteer to be there because they want – it's a smaller classroom setting, 10 to 1, 10 students to one teacher. Well, in the last 5 years of doing that, I could write a book. It's exciting. It's very exciting. One young fellow, and this was before I started teaching that environment, he comes into school. It's his first day of school. It's in the middle of the school year, and I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, middle school year, I know what this kid's going through. he doesn't have a white pillow slip for a book bag, though, so he's got one good thing going for him. But he says he comes in, and he looks bad rough. And he sits down, he puts his hands on his desk like this, and it says, F-U-C-K. You. And I'm like, he's trying to tell me something. And he looked right looked at me like that, and he put his head down. And I honestly don't remember what I did right then. But I do know that over the next few weeks, he loosened up. And eventually he shared with me that his mother had been convicted of some crimes involving drugs, and that he was court-ordered to live with his grandparents. And he's coming up from another state. And here he is. When he gets up here, his grandfather had recently lost his legs to diabetes, and his grandmother has taken care of him, but his grandmother can't clean him or move him. So when this young man goes home from school, every day he's changing diapers and cleaning his grandfather. And by the end of the year, his grandfather has passed away. And he was very close with his grandfather. This kid was going through a lot. I think one of the keys to getting through to kids that are really struggling is just unconditional love. No judgment. You're not judging them for what they're doing. And a lot of times they're going to lash out at you. And especially if you're showing them that, because some of the adults in their lives that are showing them, telling them that they're loving them or betraying them. The victory in that is this young man. I don't know what becomes of a lot of these kids, but this young kid, he performed in the classroom eventually, and he got a science. I teach science. He got a science credit, and then he moved on. Another young fellow, not too long ago, he comes to school and he got in trouble for being in possession of things that he shouldn't have been in possession of. I'd established a good rapport with this kid, and I said, but this day he came into school and he was really off the wall. He was off the chain, and he said he was really disrespecting an older lady that was working with us at the time. And she asked for help. I took the kid outside. I said, and on the way out there, I'm thinking, okay, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? What am I going to do? Okay, what am I going to say? Okay. And I thought, well, you got enough rapport with this kid. Let's go ahead and be really stern with him. Young man, you're going to need to clean up your attitude. We're not going to have that. I don't got the attitude. You got the attitude. You're getting the attitude with me. And he starts yelling. Man, that didn't work. I'm failing here. I'm like, man, this isn't going good. So I walked over to him and I said, okay, Lord, I need a new strategy. And that's one of the things that I think is important, is failing forward. You make a mistake, own your mistake. Figure out something that'll work. And I walked up to the young man and I crouched down in front of him like this. And he was standing there with his head down and his fists clenched like this. And I'm like, boy, I hope he doesn't hit me. And he says, I just said to him as I crouched down, I said, I said, young man, I really apologize for getting an attitude with you. Will you forgive me? And he just looked at me, and I said, man, I said, I'm really sorry. And he burst into tears, just, and couldn't stop. So we sat down for a few minutes, and I said, man, you're not yourself. What's going on? He said, last night, my mother came home. We got into an argument, and she said, I quit. I'm out of here. And she left them. And there was any dad in the picture, and the mom said, I'm out of here. And before she left, she said, you know, I just had an abortion because you and your brother aren't good role models. He couldn't take that. So, anyway, there's a lot of kids that, you know, go to school every day. And when you got classrooms of 30 kids, and many of them are going through things like that. But listen, we are going to get them prepared for that final test. Okay? So, anyway, thank you, guys.
Bill Kenyon. Bill Kenyon is a teacher and coach who lives in Chapel Hill. This is the American Graduate Edition of the Monty at Motorco Music Hall. It's a special produced in partnership with North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Jeff Polish. Our next storyteller is actually, she was just placed on the schedule 2 days ago. She comes to us from Trosa. You guys know Trosa? Yeah. Trosa, for those of you who don't know, stands for Triangle Residential Options for Substance Abusers. Okay? The president, Kevin McDonald, has told a story on the Monty stage about 2 years ago, and I still count that as one of the most important stories ever told on our stage. The work that he does at Trosa is amazing. Real, real work with people in need, okay? I reached out to him and to ask him for anybody that might have a story on the issue that we're dealing with, and through a couple of channels, we got our next storyteller, so let's give her a big round of applause. Alicia Vatesis.
Okay, from the intro, you could probably tell that I was a drug addict. Yeah, I'm at Trosa. So I'll start out with I started using drugs and alcohol at the age of 12. And the first time that I used, it was an awesome experience, as sad as it sounds. The comfort that I got, that I don't really care what people think of me, which was something that I struggled with a lot. You know, I came from a long line of drug addicts and alcoholics, so to, you know, mask the anxiety and the nervousness that I felt as a child, you know, with both my parents using drugs and committing crimes, I really didn't have much of a home base. My mother committed a lot of crimes, you know, writing bad checks, and, you know, those things made it hard to be a child and be normal. At the age of 9, you know, my mother had been arrested so many times that she was a regular at the jail. They knew her by name. They knew me by my name. And so this particular year, I wasn't used to having a Christmas anyway. So the police officers knew us and knew of my situation. So they got together and they brought me Christmas. So at 9 years old, you know, that was kind of freaky, but it was, you know, it was what it was. I mean, really going to school for me was something that I didn't like to do. You know, I was smart and I could have excelled if, you know, I had, you know, not cared what was going on around me, because I was taunted and picked on and all that good stuff. But it did get to me, and, you know, I let it take me to another level. So I continued to use. That feeling that I got was, you know, unbelievable. And at the age of 15, you know, I got tired of going to school and dealing with all the crap. And I thought, you know, what's the best thing I could do for me? I could get a job so I can buy my own drugs. You know, I thought that was a good idea. So that's what I did. And actually, I wasn't legally able to quit school on my own. So I convinced my, you know, drug-induced mother to sign for me to quit school. That wasn't very hard. You know, I just drug her up to the schoolhouse. And that's what she did. She signed the papers, and I quit. And the next day, I got a job at Rose's. And, you know, that was just like a whole new experience for me. I was able to, you know, do now what I wanted to do, which is what I'd pretty much been doing. So it was just to another level. I was making money. I moved out. I just started this little, you know, home life for myself, except I was high from the time I woke up until the time I passed out at night. You know, and I started out just, you know, with the basics, marijuana, cocaine, psychedelic drugs, and alcohol. It excelled through the years. I stayed a drug addict for 25 years. 25 years. And I don't know if I got stuck or I loved it so much. It was just kind of went hand in hand. I mean, I didn't know anything other than that, except that that's what, you know, that's what made me happy at the point. And I didn't know any other happiness. So at the age of 37, that's when I decided that, you know, maybe I had crapped away too many years and that I needed, you know, I needed some help. I needed long-term help. You know, and the things that I had lost along the way, I mean, my God, if you think about it, you know, because it's not about, for me, it's not about material things. I lost my adolescence. I mean, you know, I never got the chance to live a normal little girl's life. you know, I had lost freedom and independence because I thought that I had all of that. I thought I was living free and I thought I had independence because I was doing what I wanted to do. But in reality, I was hooked. You know, I could not function at that point. You know, at the end of my addiction, I couldn't function. I was physically dependent. And then, you know, I lost my education. You know, I got my GED, but, I mean, the things that I could have accomplished, you know, I started thinking about that. And I missed growing up, watching my children grow up. You know, I have two children, and they're 8 and 10. And, you know, those are things that I looked at. So I got kicked out of DCA a couple of times. That's the detox facility here. And I was like, well, crap, if I'm getting kicked out of there, then I don't know where I'm going to go. So there was actually somebody there. She told me about Trosa, and that's where I'm at now. I'm a scholar. I am assistant to the president. And, you know, I'm really happy. You know, I'm in a healthy relationship. All of the things that I never thought were possible for me are now, you know, coming together. And, you know, at this point, the possibilities are endless. I mean, you know, I'm going to start school at Durham Tech next month. You know, I'm going to go to college, you know, something that I always wanted to do. And I'm just, you know, I'm really excited about life. You know, I'm happy now. And that's all I got. Thank you.
Alicia Bates. Alicia Bates is a Trosa scholar who lives in Durham, North Carolina. This is the American Graduate Edition of the Monty at Motorco Music Hall. It's a special produced in partnership with North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Jeff Polish. I started the Monty almost 4 years ago to the day, April 22nd, 2008, in a small room at Spice Street in Chapel Hill. You guys know that? Small room. I started it because I love hearing stories from people, true stories, right? So I thought, hey, what the heck? You know, let's get some interesting people to tell true stories, and if you build it, they will come. So not only did they come, but we had a room coded for 80 people, and 140 came, and we had to turn away 30, and we broke all sorts of fire codes in the process. But, you know, we sold that out, and we've been selling out shows ever since. Now, the name The Monty is actually the name of my best friend from college, all right? We got together. I actually joined. I'm a little sorry to say. I joined a fraternity. You probably didn't know I was a fraternity type, you know? But I am. And, you know, actually, one of the requirements of joining this fraternity as a pledge is you have to actually have at least 15-minute conversation with every person in the fraternity, which probably isn't a bad idea, right? You talk to people in the fraternity. So I scheduled a 15-minute conversation with this guy named Monty. I didn't know him. It was scheduled for 3 p.m. on a Friday. I was a sophomore in college. We got together at 3, and we just started talking, telling each other stories, back and forth, story after story. Hilarious, raunchy, poignant, tragic, etc., back and forth. 10 hours later, only in college, right? 10 hours later, the conversation ended. It was 1 a.m., we had a bottle of tequila going on, and we were best friends, absolutely, and have been best friends ever since. And that's the spirit that I want to capture here at the Monty, is telling each other stories can build community. That's what we do. Our mission is to create community through the telling of stories. I think we're doing that tonight, don't you? Yeah. Let's get started with our next storyteller, okay? Cassio Noel is our next storyteller, and I've known him for, God, it's been, I don't know, not very long, but about 5 months. And we've been, he was a part of a workshop that I ran for the Orange County Literacy Council on storytelling. And I was so impressed with him that I wanted to work with him in relation to this show here. I really wanted him to tell his story, and there was a lot I wanted to learn about him, and I feel very close to him. This story has a lot of meaning to me because it's so important to him. So let's give Cassio Noel a big round of applause.
Well, I never really knew my father, but I did have other role models in my life, like my stepfather. I can remember one time me and him were screaming back and forth through his car window. I was challenging him to get out and fight because he had done something disrespectful to my mother. He pulled out of the driveway and ran over my foot. My foot was fine. However, my anger hit the roof. I picked up a rock and I launched it through the window. It hit him. I was a pitcher back then. I always had good aim. Later on, after that, he proceeded to get out the car. He chased me into the backyard. He struck me. He was a big guy, 6'4", 300 pounds. He left. Later on, he came back. And I always compared myself to a pit bull. I didn't ever back down, so I still went after him. I grabbed a pack of cigarettes from his hand. I slung him on top of the roof to enrage him. He shrugged me off. He went in and locked me outside. Later on in the evening when my mother was there, I came in. She lured me into the room with him. Once I was in the room, she proceeded to leave the room and lock it from the outside, where he could physically abuse me. When I saw that this was happening, I ran out of the room. I was 10 years old then. That was my life. That's all I knew. Just when I was in kindergarten, I was already being shuffled around from school to school because at that young of age, I was displaying such high levels of violence. I was shuffled around the schools with kids that was highly medicated and it was highly as violent as me. Around the age of maybe when I was in sixth grade, my mother and my sister, we moved to Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I went from being in a school with 30 kids to a school with 30 kids in my classroom. I felt like a shark in a sea of tuna, because I knew the real world. They didn't know the real world. Around this time, I began to run around with my cousins. They were like my brothers. Before I knew it, we were in a gang. We was gangbanging. We robbed. We stole. We protected our turf. That's what we did. A typical day in the life, what we considered a good day, is when we had stuff to sell, to make money. When we didn't, we did whatever we had to do to get finances. Around this time through my whole high school career, I didn't care about being there. I hated school. I was just there because I had to be there. But me, I never messed with the innocent. I loved the innocent kids. It was nothing more beautiful than seeing them, because they who I wanted to be. They was innocent, I wasn't. So around my 12th grade year, I decided to drop out after I had been shuffled between two more schools. And I said, I'm just through with school. It's been too long of a road. Well, one night, they changed my life. We were lured into a hotel room. We were called over there by some girls. It was on our turf. A rival gang had been called. It was a setup. They came over, knocked on the door. We opened the door, and to get out, we had to exchange gunfire. After that, we got away safe. No one got killed. No one got arrested. And I remember thinking to myself, when's this luck gonna run out? And when it run out, it's only really two ways it's gonna end, dead or in jail. But I know nothing happens overnight. You can't stop running with your gang, your brothers, the guys you feel that you've pretty much been to hell and back with. You can't just decide to go back to school in one night. I'm 21 years old now. I was locked out of life. But now I left all of that stuff alone. I went back to school and got my GED. And by me going forward now, I know that by me going forward, telling my story to kids, preventing them from going down the path that I went down, maybe then, just maybe then, I can reclaim my innocence. God bless.
Cassio Noel. Cassio Noel earned his GED in February of 2012 and lives in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. This is the American Graduate edition of The Monty at Motorco Music Hall. It's a special produced in partnership with North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Jeff Polish. And now for our last storyteller of the night, Sarah Carucci. We have a Carucci head in the house. Two. And soon, 200. Yeah. Somebody asked me during the break, how did you get in touch with Sarah? Like, how did you find her? It's actually, there are a couple of steps. It's not quite 6 degrees with Sarah Carucci, but it may be 2 degrees or three. I know a guy named Greg Meyer, who, anyone know him? Yeah, from Blue Ribbon Mentorship. He put me in touch with Danya Perry. And also Rebecca Clendenin from Communities in School, the state office, North Carolina, who then said, you must, if you were going to do this show, you must get in touch with Sarah Carucci. She's amazing. She's got incredible stories. I emailed her right away, and she's here to tell her story. So let's give Sarah Carucci a big round of applause.
You really can't see anything. So I started my journey as an educator about an hour and a half north of here, up 85, in Warren County. In my first semester of teaching, I intercepted a note between two of my eighth graders. It was a note that, at least in format, didn't differ all that much from a note I might have sent myself only a decade earlier when I was in middle school. It was a questionnaire. Things like, who do you like? Who's the best teacher? But there was a part that stood out to me. In response to the question, how old will you be when you have your first baby? Tracy, one of my eighth graders, had responded 16 and a half. A year and a half later, Tracy ended up having that theoretical baby 2 years earlier than she'd projected at the age of 14. Now, when I tell folks this story, they oftentimes want to know, how did you react when you saw that note? The reality is, I didn't. I was trying to figure out how to teach middle school Spanish in Warren County, North Carolina. It was my first semester of teaching. And I knew it had been a challenge. That was the point. I signed up for this program called Teach for America, which, by its nature, places recent college graduates with zero experience in education in front of classrooms, very full classrooms. So that's where I found myself, expecting that challenge, but also expecting that, just like any other challenge I'd found earlier in my life, with a certain amount of hard work, dedication, I figured within a relatively minimal amount of time, I would be pretty awesome at it. My students soon taught me otherwise. I couldn't even keep my kids in their seats, let alone convince them how important it was to conjugate AR verbs correctly. In fact, the only part of teaching that made sense to me way back in the beginning was the fact that these same kids who could bring me to a panic attack within a 45-minute class period, these same kids had this inexplicably tremendous hold on my heart. So that the only part of teaching that ended up making sense to me was the part I didn't think would come naturally to me at all. I could care about these kids. Tracy was probably the first student to figure that out about me. So despite the fact that, in her own words, I hadn't really figured out that whole teaching thing yet, she realized I could support her in a context that was completely not academic, but the type of support was what she needed at the time. So Tracy started spending afternoons in my classroom. She'd stay with me after school. We'd work on her other classwork, and we'd start talking about all these things that were going on in her life, a lot of which were pretty heart-wrenching, and most of which I could offer no sort of advice towards. But what I could offer was an open mind and a willing ear, and for Tracy, that was enough. When I look back at the beginning of that relationship, what I've only much more recently realized is that as much as Tracy may have needed me at the time, I needed her so much more. It was with Tracy, and eventually with other students, in those moments of connection, where I finally felt like maybe I did have a place in education. Way before I figured out how to keep my kids in their seats, and way, way before I figured out how to deliver any kind of meaningful instruction in the Spanish language, I felt useful in those moments with Tracy. I felt like I had a purpose here. In her ninth grade year, the next fall, my second year of teaching, I heard some rumors that Tracy was pregnant. I did not want to believe them, so I chose not to. But I got a call one evening from her English teacher, who was a friend of mine through Teach for America. He confirmed the fact that she was pregnant, and she's scared to tell you. I was devastated. This was so not the plan I had for Tracy. And my reaction at first was really pretty selfish. I found myself thinking, what am I supposed to do now? How am I going to cope with this? As if this was something for me to cope with. Tracy, as she often is with me, was pretty patient. So we moved forward. We got through it. About a year later, my third year of teaching, if you're keeping track, and the beginning of her 10th grade year, I decided I was going to apply to grad school. In my personal statement, I ended up telling part of her story, much like I am this evening. I talked about how, despite the fact that she had to be out of school for a good bit of time when she was pregnant and after she had her son, she ended up passing 7 out of her 8 classes that 9th grade year. I talked about how she was off to a fantastic start in 10th grade, and that if she kept it up, she was going to graduate on time with her classmates, and she would be the first of her siblings to do so. And I talked about how proud I was to support her in these 2 parallel endeavors to both finish high school and to be the best mother she could be. Now, when I wrote all that, I understood that I was reducing Tracy's story to most neatly fit this package required by a certain essay prompt. But I promise you, every word was sincere. So when I told Harvard admissions that Tracy was going to make it, she was going to get there, I said so because I believed it, because I needed it to be true, because I couldn't figure out another option for her or for me. Last June should have been when Tracy walked across the stage and got handed that diploma along with her classmates. It didn't happen. You see, when I sent off my grad school application, her life didn't get easier all of a sudden, as much as I wish it would have. She ended up receiving a subsidized voucher for childcare through the Department of Social Services. But she ended up losing that voucher within a couple months after her son missed too many days of daycare when he was sick. So those next semesters for Tracy and her high school life involved this desperate search for the perfect set of circumstances that would allow her to both finish school and provide the childcare that her son needed and deserved. She didn't end up finding it. She kept going to school when she could, but she missed a lot of days. So in February of 2010, the school dropped her from the roll. She'd missed too many days. She was too far behind. At the age of 16, Tracy became a high school dropout, which is also the age here in North Carolina where education is no longer considered compulsory. Today, Tracy's 18. She lives outside of Charlotte with her son, who's now 4, and her 9-month-old daughter. She remains a very important part of my life. When I called her the other week to get her permission to tell our story this evening, she agreed almost without hesitation. And she told me how proud she was of me. Proud. Am I missing something? But she went on to explain she was proud to see that I was still working so hard for other young people, to get them to where she hadn't yet got to. I had no idea how much words could mean to me or how long I'd been waiting to hear something like that from her. You see, I've been working these last 6 years in education, always at least in part from this place of having let Tracy down, of having let down a lot of other students who haven't made it to where I want them to make it. Today, I work here in Durham. I have for the last 2 years. I work at a small non-traditional high school for students who have dropped out and decided to come back, oftentimes despite having what seems like every odd stacked against them. I see elements of Tracy in so many of these students, particularly in the young mothers I work with. And a lot of them do make it. And when they do, it's with this extraordinary combination of courage and determination, and oftentimes of luck. It's never easy to be a young mother. But as it stands here today in North Carolina, unless you've found that perfect set of circumstances where you can provide childcare for your son or daughter, either through financial means or through the support of a loved one, unless that's you, then parenting and working to finish your education has become essentially this unnatural act. When you have waiting lists in the thousands for childcare vouchers, I don't know how else to describe it. Tracy still deserves that diploma. I can no longer pretend to know how or when she'll get it. But of course I have faith she'll get it. If you haven't figured out much else about me, I don't give up that easily. Tracy's story is in no way close to finished. But the one thing I do know is that for as long as she'll continue to have me as a small part of that story, I intend to be there. Thank you.
Sarah Carucci is a graduate coach at Communities and Schools in Durham. She lives in Raleigh, North Carolina. This is the American Graduate edition of The Monty at Motorco Music Hall. It's a special produced in partnership with North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Jeff Polish. Yeah, thank you. But let's just first thank all of our storytellers tonight. Okay, starting with Bryn Surratt, our first storyteller. Bill Kenyon. Alicia Bates. Cassio Noel. And Sarah Carucci. This program is part of American Graduate, Let's Make It Happen, a public media initiative made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thanks also to GlaxoSmithKline, the Goodnight Educational Foundation, Joseph N. Bryan Foundation, and the WUNC listeners, businesses, and organizations for their support of WUNC's American Graduate Series. This show is recorded live at Motorco Music Hall in Durham by Michelle Morano. I'm Jeff Polish.